I'm sorry, someone said good morning, and I'll just say good morning to you. And good morning, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Larry Kay from Chicago, and I'll be the host for the presentation today. Today is Sunday, August 25th, 2024. Let me give you the share ID numbers for Friday, August 23rd. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting, that number is 21,683, that's 21683. For the 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting, 21,684, that's 21684. This morning, A Vision for You presents three pertinent ideas. So our speaker, he's going to bring to life and expound a bit upon the three very important pertinent ideas found on page 60 in the big book. You know, I was thinking, there's been so many things in life, especially with we compulsive overeaters, our history is our greatest asset. Because in the sense that we each, you don't have to be a history buff by any means to recover, right? But we each arrived at the doors of OA with an intensive, and for me, a very lengthy history of things that do not work. And today in OA and in recovery, our history has added an intensive and hopefully lengthy history of things that do work. And we will, as the book says, we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And you know, there's untold millions that have found, they've lived and are currently living a sober life in the nearly 90 some years since Ebbie Thatcher first carried, you know, a message of hope to Bill. Bill was desperate. He was incomprehensibly he was a demoralized drunk, basically. And we can see in our own lives what the efforts of a few relative newcomers at the time had done for us and had done for the world, to remind us not to water down the message. Thank goodness we have people in program that don't water down the message. And also, you know, it gives us comfort not to skimp on our efforts to share this message of recovery so that greater things will come to pass, you know, and to those that came before us, like our co-founders and the early pioneers, we owe so much more. And while, you know, we recognize this spiritual program of action was never conceived or designed by our co-founders as a solo endeavor. You know, it was something to be done without the help of others. But let's also be clear about something. No human being will ever be able to bring about a psychic change in another human being. No one that I've ever worked with had a spiritual, you know, a psychic change, a spiritual experience, spiritual awakening as the result of something, you know, that Larry brought about. And they never will, frankly, they never will. And the book is very clear about that. So, you know, we do not embark on the action steps 4 through 9 by affirming, you know, my dear sponsor, I offer myself to thee, you know, to build with me and do with me as you wish. No, we don't say that. We don't say that. Nor do we exclaim, you know, my beautiful, amazing, loving sponsor, please relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do what you direct me to do. No, we don't say that. And we do not ask a sponsor or any other human being to take away our difficulties. You know, Harlan, take away my difficulties so that victory over these deficits will bear witness to others, so others can see your immense power, your love, your way of life. May I do your will always. No, I don't say that. There's only two things about this power that I must come to believe. Two specific things. There is one, and it's not me or any other human. That's it. That's the deal for me anyway. You know, let's not put any human being on a spiritual pedestal. You know why? Because by doing so, we hand them over to this disease. this wretched disease when we do that. It's not just that I'm harming myself by placing someone on a pedestal. I'm handing that person over to this disease. The doctor's opinion is very instructive on what's necessary. It says, one feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. You know what I love about this fellowship? Since AA was first established, and then later, you know, the sister programs, there's been lots of amazing human beings with varied opinions from the very beginning, right? Human beings who care deeply about recovery will always have different opinions. I mean, there was a guy in early AA by the name of Jimmy Burwell. You may have heard of Jimmy Burwell. You can Google him. And he was among the first 10 members of AA on the East Coast, and he was responsible for starting Alcoholics Anonymous in Philadelphia. And you know what Jimmy contributed, at least for me, that was so amazing? His most crucial contribution at the founding of AA came from his atheism, or as he later termed it, his militant agnosticism. He argued strongly with the early group in New York that it needed to kind of tone down what he called the God bit, you know? And I'm grateful for that, because remember, you know, the Oxford Group was a Christian organization, yet we're neither against religion nor are we for a particular one. I'm grateful for that fact. Otherwise, one could argue that there would be no OA. I mean, OA was founded essentially by a woman who in her later years loved to make sure that everyone knew that her grandson was going to medical school. You know, like evidently a very rare thing for a Jewish grandmother to do, right? And as the third tradition states, if we have the desire to stop eating compulsively, there's no place for us, if we have the desire to stop eating compulsively, there is a place for us in OA. Anyone who has this desire is welcome. You are welcome here, and you should never feel like you have to explain your personal beliefs. Anyway, the amazing thing is, despite our different life experiences, here's something we can agree on. It's on page 17, and it tells us what we can absolutely agree on. In fact, so much so that it's referred to as the powerful cement which binds us together. It says the tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. A common solution. We have discovered a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. So I like people with passion because they teach me and I learn, and they don't water down the message, and yet they do have compassion for others. And I'm so grateful for so many of them and their varied opinions. And joining us this morning to share his wisdom is Pete B. from Pennsylvania. Pete is a dedicated member of Overeaters Anonymous, and he is committed to the practice and to the teaching of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions as a way of life. So please join me with gratitude in welcoming Pete B. to the line. Hey, Pete, good morning to you.
Good morning, Larry, and thank you for covering so much of what I was going to go over. I really appreciate your service. So with that, I'm going to pass, and we'll open it for questions. Who's first? No. So thanks, Larry. Good morning, everybody. My name's Pete B. I'm a compulsive overeater. Might as well jump right in with a definition, right? So compulsive is an irresistible urge, especially one that is against one's conscious wishes. Right. So when I say I'm a compulsive overeater, I mean by in spite of my intentions, my desires, my philosophies, my intellect, or any resources I enlist, I go to food because I believe it will do something for me that it has never been able to do. And I also believe that it won't do something to me that my experience tells me it's always done. Is that I'm going to get an abnormal reaction. The reaction that I get, that's the phenomenon of craving. That distinguishes me from other people. That's what makes me a distinct entity. And that phenomena makes it close to impossible to stop once I start putting certain substances into my body. Not all substances, certain substances. So in effect, I become completely powerless. I've recovered. By God's grace and mercy, I've recovered from that position, from that condition. I have had a spiritual awakening as a result of working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in entire abstinence. I remain entirely abstinent today under any and all conditions, situations, or any circumstances. My sanity has been restored, and I now have proper use of my will and all of my God-given faculties. I've established a relationship with the God of my understanding. I've aligned my will with hers. And I have real freedom today. In all accounts, it feels as though the problem does not exist for me. And I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to the recovered members of Alcoholics Anonymous and Overeaters Anonymous for helping me understand the seriousness and the significance of this condition, as well as the truth about the solution and the process that brings about recovery. You know, just real quick, I've been abstinent since May 17th of 2017. That's a lot of 17s. I've been recovered since August of 2017. I've lost about 65 pounds since becoming abstinent in 2017. I'm down about 86 pounds from my last known top weight. It did take me 12 years to get 1 year abstinent. I've been in and out of OA since like around 2004 or 2005. I'm not really sure when I first went. And I've had my share of all of the different OA flavors, you know, gray sheet, how, who, what, when, FA, where, all those. I've dipped my toe into all of the fellowships that come out of that come out of Overeaters Anonymous. And, you know, I did find my way into OA from AA, and, you know, in spite of what everybody, you know, seems to commonly share, I did, you know, my credits did transfer. You know, they did transfer for me. You know, I don't make any claims of being any kind of authority or guru. I'm certainly not a scholar or any kind of historian or expert on, I'm not an expert on anything. Not even myself, I don't even think. But what I do know is I'm a garden variety compulsive overeater, and all that I know is what I am. I know whose I am. I know for sure what I have, and most importantly, what I've recovered from and what keeps me in that recovered state. I don't have any interest in trying to make anyone align with my opinions or my interpretations of our recovery program. I only know what seems to be working for me and what our literature, the AA Big Book and the AA 12 and 12, says about our condition and the process of recovery that we go through. So if you hear me say something that contradicts the information in our literature, bring it to my attention when we have questions. Call me, email me anonymously, send me something on WhatsApp. I get a lot of those. Bring it to my attention. I'd love to hear it, right? Because I'm here to learn. I'm here to contribute, I'm here to be of service. And I'm certainly not trying to win a popularity contest. I can assure you of that, right? You know, sometimes what I have to say, sometimes it says it rubs people the wrong way. And I get it, right? I don't have the best delivery. But my intentions are never to be hurtful. Intentions are always to be of service to God and service to my fellows. And I'm the way I am because I'm the way I am. But I also take this super, super serious, right? It's one of the few things in my life that I'm really passionate about. Now, I've been around OA and in recovery for a long time for me, okay, right? I've been sober a long time. I've been in OA a long time. And I get frustrated. I get frustrated. It should be no surprise that OA's failure rate is embarrassingly low. I don't even think we keep track of it, to be honest. I don't know if there's a stat out there. I don't know. You know, recently we had a friend tell us that the chances of recovering from cancer are better than recovering from this condition. You know, so if that's the case, as members and fellows, don't we have to assess what we're doing and how we're doing it and ask ourselves hard questions? Are we carrying this message in the big book? Have we altered what it says and describes to do to better fit to our personalities rather than altering ourselves and our message to better align what it says? You know, we'll hear a lot of times people say, you know, they'll talk about their experience and they'll get that snarky, how's your way working for you, right? And that's like snarky way. And that's like to say, come on, try our way. Well, if less than 1% of the people who come here recover, don't we get to ask ourselves, how's our way working for us? Somebody's unmuted. I don't know if that's you, Larry. So look, I'm not trying to be on those soapbox. I got something to talk about. I'm going to get to it. But I will tell you this. I hated being fat. I hated myself because I couldn't get myself to follow any diet or meal plan that I knew would give me what I so desperately wanted, and that was to be in a healthy body and be fit and energetic and free of the compulsion to overeat and ingest substances that I knew were harmful. I hated using food to address the problems of using food. You know, I would just change the diet, right? You know, just use food to get over the problem of food. Like I said, it took me 12 years. The reason why it took me 12 years to get a year abstinent, it wasn't because I wasn't doing this thing we call the 10 step, right? It wasn't because I wasn't living in steps 10, 11, and 12. I can assure you that. It was because I had an intellectual understanding of what it means to be a compulsive overeater. But I didn't grasp the absolute necessity to take this condition as serious as it is. And how entire abstinence is absolutely essential in order to bring about the psychic change that our big book describes. So I'm going to talk about, Larry said it's on page 60, right? You know, three pertinent ideas, our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostics, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and that God could and would if he were sought. You know, in the OA invitation for you, it says that the OA recovery program is patterned after that of Alcoholics Anonymous. We use AA's 12 steps and 12 traditions, changing only the words alcohol and alcoholic to food and compulsive overeater. And we know that the definition of an alcoholic is a person that's affected with alcoholism. And we know that alcoholism is a persistent, excessive consumption of alcohol resulting in impairment of health, often included physiological and psychological addiction, alcoholic dependency. But what I've, somebody could tell me if I'm wrong, in a way, we don't have a word for alcoholism. Right? We don't have a word for alcoholism. And isn't that what we recover from? Right? Think about that first one, how the paragraph starts. It says, you know, where is our description of the alcoholic? Where does that come from? Right? What, the medical assessment, right, or the description of what an alcoholic is, we get from the doctor's opinion, right? That's the medical assessment, right? And that tells us we have an allergy of the body. It tells us we're a distinct entity. It tells us it did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality or outright mental defective. It tells us that any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. It also says that an alcoholic will never recover from the physical aspect of this condition, right? But that's not our description. Right? Our description of the alcoholic, that comes from those who actually have the condition, and that's in More About Alcoholism. And what does that tell us? Well, it describes the mental aspect of our condition, right? It tells us that we have illusions. It tells us that we're delusional. It tells us that we're plagued with self-deceit. It mentions insanity three times and insane twice in that one chapter. It describes what happens to us before taking the first drink or bite for us. It also tells us that many of us have gotten to the point where we were beyond human aid way before we ever expect it. And it tells us that we'll have no effective mental defense and where the defense must come from, right? Because on page 43, it says the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases. Neither he nor any other human being can provide such defense. His defense must come from a higher power. But that's also the part of the disease that we actually recover from, right? Because the book goes on to say that sanity returns. We become sane. Right? In the chapter interaction, it mentions that our thinking will become along the lines of inspiration. It tells us that four times. So our thinking does change. And when I refer to myself as recovered, that is what I'm referring to. That is what I have recovered from. The chapter, also in the beginning, it mentions the chapter to the agnostics. And what does that tell us, right? It gives us the only two questions we have to ask ourselves to determine if we have with the doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there is a solution, and more about alcoholism described. It says, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. And if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. See, it also tells us what our dilemma was, is, because it's written by a person that has recovered, right? It says lack of power was our dilemma. It tells us what we have to find and what the book is about, right? Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. And solve doesn't mean just for the day, like we love to, you know, we love to say. It doesn't mean we go to bed recovered and wake up unrecovered. That doesn't mean. Solve means the problem is effectively dealt with by the power we find and develop a relationship with through this process. Doesn't it make sense? If we lack something, then we find what we were lacking. Don't we essentially now have what we were lacking? See, words are important. So is context and tense and punctuation. And the Big Book uses words and phrases in present tense, and it uses things in past tense. And it's not us to change them in order to align with some other narrative, right? Words have definition, and it's important that we don't substitute our definition of the words used in the Big Book, because doing so changes the message that we're supposed to be carrying, right? Even in our step one, we hear it all. It says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. That's in past tense. So if I'm not triggering the allergy by ingesting the substances or engaging in the behaviors that cause the phenomenon of craving, if I've cleared away the wreckage of my past and addressed the things in my present that block me from having a relationship with this power, if food doesn't have a mouth and can't talk to me and it has no power unless it's in my body, and most importantly, if I've given my life and my will over to my creator, like Bill describes on page 13, there I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him, to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. Or on page 158 for AA number 3, the lawyer, he says, on the third day, the lawyer gave his life to the care and direction of his creator. So if sanity has been restored and I am in fact recovered, how can my life be unmanageable? It's no longer my life. I've turned it over to God. And in doing so, I've gained independence. Right? That's what the AA 12 and 12 says in step three, page 36. It says, therefore, dependence, as AA practices it, is really a means of gaining true independence of the spirit, which tells me that's what we're after. So let's take a look at these questions, right? A, that we were alcoholic and couldn't manage our lives. I talked a lot about it. What does that mean? We have an allergy of the body, obsession of the mind. There's a physical manifestation of the disease. It's triggered by ingesting a substance or engaging in a behavior that causes the phenomenon of craving. The word phenomenon means we know it exists. We don't know where it comes from. The reaction cannot be triggered by our emotions. It can't be triggered by our fears, our jealousy, or our poor relationship skills. Like, could these cause me to think I'm hungry? Absolutely. Right? Could these cause me to desire ease and comfort? Absolutely. But that doesn't make me alcoholic. That makes me human. That comes from the Creator. We are designed to avoid pain and seek pleasure. And every living creature derives ease and comfort from being nourished. See, but unfortunately, I conditioned myself to use substances that have been designed by the smartest scientist in the world to trigger something and cause a reaction. Right? By definition, that is a form of being addicted. But addiction isn't the only problem. Right? If I'm addicted means I'm physically and mentally dependent on a particular substance and unable to stop taking it without incurring adverse effects. Right, and lots of people address addiction with abstinence. I was addicted to nicotine and cocaine and plenty of other things, and I still have lots of addictions, and some of them I really like. But I could tell you this, I don't ever sit around and wonder, you know, if there's any new cocaine out there. I wonder what it smells like. I don't do that. I abstain from it, and the problem is gone. See, my problem is a compulsive overeater with alcoholism, which to me is just the refusal to admit that my body and my mind react differently than other people. On page 30, in the big book, it says that the delusion that we are like other people, not the delusion that we eat like other people, the delusion that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. I'm a distinct entity. I've never been like other people, and I'll never be like other people. There are things I have to do and things I have to avoid that plenty of other people don't have to worry about. I have a mind that will minimize, justify, and rationalize that one bite or not taking the action necessary to ensure my food is free of the substances that cause the abnormal reaction. I'll always minimize that, right? And that physical condition, that's coupled with an obsession of the mind. Right, and that obsession of the mind is not that I feel different than I think other people feel. And it's not that, you know, I want you to love me or like me more than I think other people want that. It's not that I isolate when I'm lonely. It's not that I don't feel good enough or even that I feel better than. It has nothing to do with my lack of ego or excessive ego. Right, the obsession of the mind is on page 23. It says there is an obsession that somehow, someday they will beat the game. There's an idea that somehow, someday, he will control, on page 30, it says that he will control and enjoy his drinking. It's the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. On page 55, it said he had, of course, the familiar alcoholic obsession that few knew of his drinking. See, we're all human beings, and we're always going to be human beings. Are some of us quirky and different? I know I am. Do we have issues with relationships? I certainly do. Are these problems any different for me than they are for other humans? All that I've ever been is me, so I don't know the answer to that question. But my observations are that we all have problems and challenges, but that is not what makes me a compulsive overeater. What makes me a compulsive overeater is that in spite of everything I know and how big or how small the circumstance is, I turn to food or a behavior that triggers my allergy, and my mind and my body will, all my mind and body will do is come up with more evidence to keep me ingesting that food and engaging that behavior. You know, and the last part of that A says, could not manage own lives. What does that mean, right? So that means, so I may have been maladjusted to life before I started to compulsively overeat, or I may have become maladjusted to life because I started to eat. But what I've come to realize is that when it happened or why it happened is not really relevant. And figuring out when or why it happened or what may have caused it will not do anything to address it. The fact that we have this condition and we will never, ever not have it, right? It can't be outworked or outthought or outmanaged. Weighing and measuring my food or weighing and measuring my emotions, they won't suffice in addressing it. It doesn't matter how fast or how slow I do the steps. The bottom line is that the obsession is either going to be lifted by a power greater than myself or it isn't. That all starts with what my dear friend Nancy P says, right? Surrender, surrender, surrender. See, I had to give up on the idea that I'm going to be able to depend exclusively on my unaided will to get me to stop and stay stopped. I think it also means that I must give up on thinking you or anyone else is going to be able to manage it for me. You know, in Bill's story on page 13, it says, belief in the power of God plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Like, those are the requirements to get and stay recovered. So the second pertinent idea said, probably no human power could have relieved their alcoholism. What is human power? Well, OA is human power. A sponsor is human power. This magical 10-step partner we seem to have, that's human power. Our fellows, me, I'm human power. Right? Is human power irrelevant and unnecessarily? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for human power. See, connection and relation, that's a natural human instinct. There's a reason why it feels good. Because we're made that way. But that connection and our relationships will not be enough to solve our problem. If we allow ourselves to put our reliance and dependence on our fellows and our human resources, they will fail us because they, like us, are humans. And humans fall short. And it's not because they're bad or they're ill-intentioned. Right? We have to remember, while human power and connection is a natural human need and instinct, if we allow that to take the place of our required dependence on God, it's likely that our recovery will be on shaky ground. At least I found that was for me, right? On the AA 12 and 12 on page 114, it says, if we place instincts first, we've got the cart before the horse. We shall be pulled backward into disillusionment. But when we are willing to place spiritual growth first, then and only then, do we have a real chance? You know, I don't mean to contradict what Larry said in the beginning, but the big book was written as an instruction manual, right? From AA.org, it says the book was first published in 1939, and its purpose was to show other alcoholics how the first 100 people got sober. The plan, as I understand it, was to send it out to alcoholics so that they could understand the condition and the solution and have a spiritual experience on their own, find fellows. But essentially, they had to have that on their own. And look, man, the 12 steps, they only mention other people in step 5, 9, 10 if we harm someone, and 12. So in 3.5 of the steps of 12, or 71% of the steps, other people aren't even mentioned. And they're definitely not required. So if we align to the first pertinent idea, we have to see that our dependence, our reliance, our very lives will depend on us creating a relationship with this power. Can human power be helpful? Yeah, I think only if it leads to dependence on a power greater than ourselves. Right? The doctor's opinion, even the doctor's opinion says that one feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. And on page 34, it says, whether such a person can quit upon non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. You know, in OA, we put great emphasis on human power. And I'm not suggesting that doing so is completely wrong. I mean, I certainly understand, you know, I certainly needed someone for guidance, particularly with my food and helping me put this condition in the same context as I put my alcoholism. But I'm so grateful that my sponsor never allowed me to become dependent on her for my recovery. You know, anytime I had an issue, she would direct me to the big book and help me see what the big book said about my issue. Right? Anytime I asked her what to do, she directed me to ask my God what my God would have me be or my God would have me do. She never tried to solve my problem or tell me what the big book said. She directed me to find the answers in the big book myself. And to go directly to my God for the power and guidance and direction I was seeking. And we love to talk about the set-aside prayer, right? The set-aside prayer says to set aside everything we think we know for a new experience. Not set aside everything we think we know for what we think you know, right? So let's take a look at the third pertinent idea, that God could and would if he was Saul. You know, in all of the AA, in all of the anonymous programs, we all get to decide what God is to us. We all get to make that decision, right? Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. We can make it as big or as small as we want to make it. It doesn't matter. But not having one, if we have progressed to the point where we lost the power of choice, not having one is not an option. If there's any hope of getting recovered, right? We don't have the only method of having a spiritual experience. There are other ways out there, and people have been having them since the beginning of time, way before this ever existed. But the 12 steps of AA offer us a process or a method of having one that is proven to be 100% successful because it's practiced in entire abstinence. Anything that we put in place or substitute for the guidance and direction from God is inconsistent with what our literature says about our condition and our solution. Is there a bridge or a period of time where we rely on other things, other people, meetings, sponsors, fellows? Absolutely. But these are a means to an end and not the independence of the spirit, in my opinion, that the AA 12 and 12 describes. The intended destination, becoming recovered, is about using our God-given resources consistent with their intended purpose. Right? On page 83, it says, as God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. The word recovered means that we've returned to normal. On page 84, it says, we've suddenly realized that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. You know, I hear people talk about sometimes the disease, the compulsive overeating disease, like it's a spectrum disorder. I don't know. I guess that means that if some people have the condition worse than others, I don't know. Say that, right? Obviously, some people have gone way further in the disease than others have. So, and I guess in that sense, it may be the case, right? I also know people in OA have different forms of the disease, and some of these forms are known to be the deadliest of any mental illness, right? So it's very, very, very serious, right? So I guess the severity of the condition varies, but that doesn't mean that we have a spectrum solution or a different way of interpreting the literature or working the steps based on how the disease is different in each of us. Right, because we're told there's no middle-of-the-road solution. Regardless of how low or high your bottom was, it says half measures availed us nothing. Regardless of how low or how high your bottom was, basically, if you have what the big book describes as our condition, or even if you potentially have it, doing less isn't going to help you. But it also means that doing more or modifying the solution isn't going to get you anything any more recovered than anything else, right? We don't need to add requirements. We don't need to change the language. We don't need to add punctuation where it doesn't exist, right, just to address some different form of the condition. These 12 steps are worked the same way in all of the anonymous programs. So we've got to ask ourselves, whose message are we carrying? Are we prioritizing getting through the steps like our hair was on fire over actually processing and understanding what the literature says about the condition and the process that brings about recovery just because it sounds catchy? We talk so much about this magical, contrived 10-step practice that so many are relying on to get them through any emotion. Is it the buildup of emotions that's the problem? Or could it possibly be, I'm not saying it is, but could it possibly be that we never really actually took an effective third step? Did I really turn my life and will over to God as I understand God? Right? In the AA 12 and 12 on page 34, it says the effectiveness of the whole AA program will rest upon how well and earnestly we have tried to come to a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. Are we encouraging people to treat symptoms versus addressing the cause? Right? If I only learn to manage my emotions well, I'll be okay. Could this practice actually be self-centeredness that we're using to try to overcome our self-centeredness? Doesn't it say on page 84, our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness? Is relying on some input from some other human being just because I felt some kind of basic human emotion, is that, have I been returned to sanity? In the AA 12 and 12 on page 89, it says a great many of us have never really acquired a habit of accurate self-appraisal. How are we ever going to develop a habit if we never actually practice self-appraisal? Where is our dependence? And who or what behavior am I relying on? I don't, why would I consider step 10 an event? As in like my step 10s, right? We don't treat any other step that way. But yet we treat this like it's an event. Growth is never an event. Growth is always a process. And our step 10 is no different in OA than it is in any other A fellowship. So I'm going to start wrapping up here because I'm getting close. So, right. So look, we're all free to practice this any way we want to practice it. We got to do what works for us, right? That's our right. But we're working with people's lives in these fellowships. We owe it to them to share what the literature says about our process and guide them to seek direction and inspiration from God. Implying that someone will return to the food if they don't do something a certain way, or explaining to someone that they ate because they didn't manage their emotions by counseling with another member and doing steps 4 through 9 every time something disturbed them, that's inconsistent with what our literature says. And if it's inconsistent with what the literature says, then it's not this message. Our big book only offers 2 warnings for when we might return to drinking or food. On page 35 in Jim's story, it says, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk 6 times in rapid succession. And on page 70, it says, suppose we fall short of our chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean that we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but it's only a half truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we've done and have an honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and we'll have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We're not theorizing. These are facts of our experience. So I'm just going to shut up with I'm super grateful for this opportunity. I love Overeaters Anonymous. You people are my tribe. I love studying and breaking down the big book and looking up words and all that stuff. It just gets me going, and I really love it, and I love all of you, and I hope that and I value every single one, and every single one of us is necessary. The last quote I'm gonna bring up is in the AA 12 and 12 on page 110. It says what we're supposed to be doing. It says we sit in AA meetings and listen, not only to receive something ourselves, but to give the reassurance and support which our presence can bring. If our turn comes to speak at a meeting, we again try to carry AA's message. And I hope that I've done an effective job of carrying that message. And with that, I'm going to pass. Hello?
Larry, press star one.
Larry, hit star one.
How about that? I was thanking Pete. Let me thank Pete again. Pete, thanks so much for your generous use of your time this morning. We're so appreciative. You know, we interpret words to understand and extract meaning, and language is such a difficult thing sometimes, for me anyway. So when we get interpretation, that's how I learn. And I learn from everybody. So appreciate you. And with that, let me first give you the share ID for Pete's presentation this morning, and then we will move to a question and answer. So get ready with questions only, please. Okay, so the share ID for today's presentation is 21,685. That's 21685. And so now let's transition to our Q&A. And so if you have a question for Pete, what I would ask you to do, there's a couple of things. You can unmute by pressing star one to unmute your phone, and then give me your first name, and then we'll take a list of names. Who has a question for Pete?
Chris M.
Chris.
Jen P.
Jen P.
Sonia S.
Sonia S.
Hannah Yeka.
Hannah Yeka.
Jackie A. from Connecticut.
Jackie A.
Loretta H.
And Loretta.
Toby W.
Toby.
And Golda H.
We're going to
Golda
stop with
H.
Golda.
In Israel.
Golda and Israel, guess what we're going to do? We're going to stop with you for this first go-round, and hopefully we'll have time for more. We'll see where we're at. So here's who I heard in this particular order. So if you're not Chris M., we would ask that you mute. Then we have Jen, Sonia, Hanayeta, Jackie, Loretta, Toby, and Golda. And once you're done with your question, if you'd be kind enough to mute again so Pete has a clear line there. Let's start with Chris M. Chris, good morning. What question do you have for Pete?
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, moderator. Thank you, Pete, so much for your share. Really, really enjoy listening to your shares throughout the vision meetings. The question I have is, I think I'm correct in remembering that, I don't know if I want to say, you're kind of a renegade maybe in the program, in terms of maybe I've heard you say, like, you kind of do things a little, I want to say differently, but not as maybe as strict as some of us have been told to do things in the past. Maybe I'm wrong. I might be mixing you up with someone else, but I thought so. And just from listening to you today, and I just wondered, you know, when I was in the program years ago, it was bad to question your sponsor or question like what they were asking you to do. And I just wondered if you had those experiences where you felt like, I don't know if this is really big book or this might be just coming from my sponsor, not from the program, how you dealt with that kind of stuff. Because we're vulnerable, you know, as people who are sick. And sometimes we're not quite sure, I think, what we're supposed to be doing and not doing. I don't know if you've come across that. Do you have any experience with dealing with that kind of challenge?
Well, Chris, thanks for the question. I appreciate it. And I don't know. I'm not sure what you were referring to as strict as some other people do. I don't know what that. I don't know what you meant by that. But I'll just stick with your question versus your comments, okay? Because I'm pretty rigid with regard to what I do for recovery. But I think I kind of mentioned that in my presentation, right? It's not my job as a sponsor to tell you what the big book means. It's my job as a person seeking recovery to go in and find out what it means for myself, right? I'm supposed to be getting my guidance and my direction, regardless if I have one day absent or the thousands or hundreds of days that I have now. That's supposed to be coming from God. And I've been given a brain, and I've been given character, and I've been given intellect, and I've been given discernment. And it's my job to process the information the way the information's written. Ed, because of what somebody said, take that as that what it means. It's up to me to figure out for myself what it means. And guess what? We have a surefire, fail-safe. If I fall short and I do it wrong, reconcile it. I have to with an apology. If I've harmed someone, I make amends, and I try to do better the next day. Right? I can't go wrong. The only way that I can go wrong, the only way I can make a mistake, is if I pick up the food and trigger the phenomenon of craving. Right? All I have to do is try. And see, I don't like to do the work. I want you to do the work for me and tell me what I have to do and when I have to do it and how I have to do it. I want to put my trust and reliance in you versus putting my trust and reliance on where it must reside, because you will always fail me. Right? We're not supposed to be putting ourselves in that position. We have separate, groups that come together that are just in place to tell people what to do and how to do it and how many phone calls to make and how many 10 steps to do a day and what to do and where to report your 11 step to. Well, I don't see where it says any of that in the literature we're all supposed to be studying. Right. So, yeah, you come across, that's where we're supposed to be. My job as a sponsor is to stay recovered. That's it. With that, I pass.
Okay. Thanks for the question, Chris. We're going to move on to Jen, followed by Sonia. Before we do, if we could stick to the question, just in the interest of time and a little bit less commentary and more of the right to the question so Pete can answer that. Jen, your turn.
Good morning, Larry, and good morning, Pete. Thank you so much. So grateful for your talk this morning on three pertinent ideas. You mentioned the dependence on God leads to greater independence, and you also talked about how important it is to go to God, that the connection with other people is important, but it's so important first, to go to God. Could you talk about how that looks in your own life? And how do you distinguish and make sure that you're going to God first in the third step truly before you're taking everything to others? Could you talk a little bit about that? It would be helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, in turning my life, Jen, thanks for the question. In turning my life and my will over to the care of God, as I understand God, my understanding is that my life is no longer my business. What shows up because God intended it to show up, and what goes away because God intended it to go away. I have the only choice I have in the matter is to accept what it is. If it's something that came that I like, I'm grateful for the gift. If it's something that goes away that I don't like, that I don't like that it's gone, I'm grateful for the lesson, right? The whole process is about growing and understanding and effectiveness, the whole entire process, right? And so I have to know, like, I turn my life and will over care of God. This is the way it's supposed to be. My job is to use my resources, use my gifts, use my skills, my character, to face any challenge that I'm currently facing. There's a lot of shit that hurts, man. There's a lot of things that happen that are sort of self-inflicted, right? But I know, like, there's no question in my mind that this pain is actually indicating that there's growth ahead of me. There's growth happening, right? I'm going to grow through this. I serve a loving and merciful God. He loves me like my dog loves me. That means I can kick him, avoid him, neglect him, talk bad about him. But if I call his name, he's going to come up to me with his tail wagging and his tongue hanging out of his mouth, drooling, just hoping for me to connect with him. Right? And I know that, left to my own devices, I'm just going to cause myself more trouble. And even worse than that, I'm going to cause more trouble for everybody in my life. So So I just trust and rely. Like whatever's going on is going on for a reason. And you know what my track record tells me, Jen? My track record tells me that God's been doing a pretty good job. I'm happy, joyous, and free, right? I live a life beyond my wildest dreams. I have pride and dignity. I'm in a healthy body. I'm fit. I'm energetic. You know, I go where I want, when I want, with who I want. And with that, I'll pass.
Thanks, Jen. Okay, next up with the question is Sonia, followed by Hannah Yetta. Sonia, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Pete, for your message. And my question is, you mentioned that you came into OA 2007 and then you've been recovered since 2017. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that shift and what it was like for you.
Thank you, Sonia, for the question. So I came into OA around 2000. I can't remember if it was 2004 or 2005. And I got recovered in 2017. And the reason why I could never get abstinent and stay abstinent before was because of, you know, the book talks about lack of proportion. Right? I never took the condition as serious as it needs to be taken in order to do anything and everything that's necessary to ensure that I don't ingest the substances that cause the phenomenon of craving. I wasn't willing to go to any length. I wasn't willing to take every, to read every label, to not put in my body something that I don't know what's in it, right? Because that's the kind of adherence that's required. Because like I said, nothing can cause the phenomenon of craving without ingesting the substance or engaging the behavior that causes it. I wasn't willing to go to any lengths because I treated this disease like it was the little sister to my alcoholism. I would go to any lengths not to drink, no matter what, make as many phone calls, go to as many meetings, do whatever anybody said to do, right? But when it came time to saying no to somebody because they made something special for me and I didn't know what's in it, or it had something in it that I'm allergic to, right? Oh no, I wouldn't do that, right? If it's ingredient number 6, I guess that's going to be okay. I would never eat a rum cake and rum was the ingredient number 6. Why would I eat a salad dressing where, you know, corn syrup was ingredient number 6? You know, this thing, we need to take deadly, it just needs to be taken that serious. And I could not get what I was so desperately after, behaving the way I behaved. You know, the shift didn't come from anybody's message. The shift didn't come from, you know, our beloved Harlan's, you know, meeting, or what Larry talks about, or what some of the, you know, just the phenomenal members of this group talks about. The shift came from the beatings I took from food. I was sitting in my office chair with a pound of roasted and salted mixed nuts in one hand and the big book in the other, praying to put the food down, and I couldn't put the food down. It's really uncomfortable to be abstinent or recovering and have a desire to eat. That's uncomfortable. But you know what's unlivable? You know what's worse than that? What's so worse than that is eating the food and having a desire to be abstinent and not having the ability to. Larry talked about it in the beginning. I was incomprehensibly demoralized. So the shift became by actually a moment of clarity and seeing that life, the way it, doing the things that I'm doing, is not serving me, and I made a decision to do everything that, you know, that the book tells me to do in order to have a psychic change, and I had one. Thanks.
Hey, thanks, Sonia. Okay, we have Hannah Yetta with the question, followed by Jackie. Hannah Yetta, good morning.
Good morning, Larry.
There you are.
Good morning, Pete. This is Hane Yetta from Texas. First of all, thank you, both of you. But Pete, you said something at the very beginning that was a negative thing about yourself, that your delivery is not always so great. I don't remember what you said exactly, but I'm here to tell you that anytime I hear you, your delivery is awesome. So that's first. Then you were talking about your credits transfer, unlike some people who say they don't transfer. I wondered a little bit more about that, but first I wanted to say that when I'm in OA and I only go to OA meetings, that I can work my AA program in OA with the steps in OA. But when I was only going to AA meetings, I lost my OA program. So have you ever had that experience, and why do you think your credits transfer? That's my question. And I want to thank you in advance since I have to mute.
Thank you, Hanayeta. Thank you for the question. So this is what I mean by that. I had a spiritual experience when I got sober. I put the alcohol down, put the drugs down, turned my life from all over care of God, walking hand in hand in the sunlight of the spirit, reading the big book, sponsoring people, doing all those things, right? I had a comprehension of what the 12 steps are. Right. I understood what working with others is all about. You know, could recite the big book chapter and verse, just like, you know, many of the members of this group can. Right. But all that came over. Never had your abstinence. Right. And you can know this stuff front, back and sideways if you're not abstinent. If we have the phenomenon of craving, something happens in our mind and our body. And it's impossible to have the essential relationship with the Creator when that's going on. So while I had freedom, I didn't have real freedom. While I was getting ready to pick up my shiny 20-year coin, I was thinking in the back of my mind, what my AA recovery needs is maybe a relapse to put me back on track. Right, because I kept thinking, if I'm doing so well and everybody's telling me how good I'm doing, why do I feel so bad? And the reason why I felt so bad is because in my meditation practice, I was getting guidance from the God of my understanding that I'm doing things that are hurting me, that I'm doing things that are contrary to what I'm saying I want to be. And I was hurting myself, but I didn't have the ability to stop hurting myself because I was straight up addicted to these substances. Right, so the one essential thing that's necessary to recover is entire abstinence, and that I never had. All that other stuff I had. And what I found for me is that by doing the steps this time in entire abstinence, the way that they're outlined in the book, and practicing the steps the way that they're outlined in the book, I have, in fact, had the spiritual experience that I was so desperately seeking before, and I have the freedom that the book talks about. You know, so that was my experience, and that's what I mean. I don't, you know, these things. You know, we have all of these sayings in these fellowships, and they're fine. You know, they're fine because they help you to they're catchy, and they're easy to remember. And a lot of times when early on, it's difficult to put our thoughts together. But like I said earlier, this thing's about growth, growing in understanding and effectiveness. And we have to start letting, you know, setting aside what everybody says something is and says something says for what it actually says. I'll pass.
All right, next up we have Jackie, followed by Loretta. Jackie, good morning to you.
Good morning, Pete, my grand sponsor. It's Jackie A. from Connecticut. Thank you, Larry, and everybody on the line. I hope you're ready for this challenging question, sir. I've always struggled with a vision for you's purpose, full intent on just discovering the big book alone, and I'm hoping you can break this down for me. So how do you process that as a member of OA, and that as Roseanne was our founder, and that how there's like the 12 and 12, there's OA World Service, there's multiple literature, we have incredible service bodies, I'm a trusted servant. Like, how do you compute that when it comes to the big book? Because I've always struggled with a vision for you's primary purpose of just discovering the big book, when even like, you know, there was so many more AA literatures that came out, and the diversity of 12-step programs in general, whether it's how long it takes to go through the steps, what the traditions are. It takes years to go through different programs. So I always struggled with it. I never heard emotional sobriety being focused on in the big book, where in OA, I always heard we have a three-legged stool. So it always contradicted me. I love the shares in this meeting and I care so much about it, but it sickens me. And I didn't know how you wrestled that as an OA member.
Okay. So I just want to make sure I understand what the question.
It feels like everything that came after the big book is void in a vision for you. Absolutely everything that came after the big book, it's irrelevant. If it's written in the 12 and 12, it's irrelevant. If it's written in the abstinence book, it's irrelevant. If it's written in the OA literature, you go to a workshop, you go to the new plan of eating, it's absolutely irrelevant because the big book told you no. It's just, that's what it feels. It kind of feels like that's the message I get when I go to an A Vision for You meeting.
Yeah, well, you know what? Okay, so thank you for the question. I don't know. I think AA says, I think A Vision for You says what its message is, that you can become recovered by practicing the 12 steps and the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we have the big book. The only problem with every recovery fellowship is that it's full of really, really sick people. That's just the bottom line. You know what I mean? And anybody can interpret anything they want to interpret, the books are written in English. We're not going from ancient Greece to English, right? They have words, standard definitions. They use regular grammar. There's not alternative uses of the English language, right? So, if you want to, I don't know how different you can interpret something. But the fact is that we have a book that was written that we follow. If somebody has given you the impression that you can't use any of the other ones, I've heard, several special editions that reference the AA 12 and 12. The AA 12 and 12 was written 15 years after the AA big book, right? So you figure, if I asked you a question when you were 1 year old, would the same response be consistent when you're 15 years old, right? So they wrote the 12 and 12 gives you some clarity on what the instructions are, right? Because it gets more experience. We hear many members talk about outside pieces of literature without identifying them as outside pieces of literature. Shit, every time you reference the set-aside prayer, that's not in any one of our, it's not in any of our literature. Right? So all that stuff is freely to, we can utilize. A Vision for You simply just breaks down the big book line by line, chapter by chapter, and we're studying it, I think, because there's a lot of value in doing that versus a lot of value in, just claiming my seat and let you know how my program's going. I think that there's a lot of value in that because it focuses on the solution and not the problem. And the problem is selfishness and self-centeredness. So this gets us out of ourselves and supposed to be getting us into other people. So I hope that answers your challenging question.
Thanks, Jackie, for the question. And next we have Loretta, followed by Toby. Loretta, good morning.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for you all the time, along with my precious God and Pete. You all are saving my life, Loretta H. Pete, okay, you said, and I believe this in my heart, God does for me what I can't do for myself. I actually use the third step as my investment plan for the day. And I would like you to share with me, not food stuff, but because I do that, I've had a lot of miracles happen to me that unbeknownst to me, and it's just what I needed. So have you had those kind of miracles just from practicing the program and really, really relying on God and His vision and turning your actions in your life over and thinking over to Him? It may be an outside issue, but I know you have, and I just wanted to hear some of them.
I mean, thank you, Loretta. hear some of them. My God, I was in a hopeless condition of mind and body. You know what I mean? Like everything that I ever tried to address my shortcomings led me to failure. You know what I mean? Like I turned to a fellowship of and a program of recovery, you know, where my scorecard read zero. You know, and I made a decision that from this point, you know, at some point in time, I made a decision that from this point forward, I was gonna let God be the director, and what shows up is what God wants to show up, and what goes away is because what God wants to go away. And like I said, I've had unbelievable blessings. You know, I could fill a spreadsheet with all of the, you know, I'm about to hang up my employment. I'm in the best shape I've ever been in my entire life. I have a long life ahead of me, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm having some challenges in my marriage, and things are getting disrupted a little bit there. But I'm following what I think I'm supposed to be following and doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I know that everything's going to be okay. It's not a question to me. It's not a question to me. And you know what? Like, I'm not in a program. You know, like, I'm not in program. This is my life. And I let God be the director. Every single day, I ask for guidance and direction. Every single day, I listen for what I think that is, and every single day, I act on what I think my God would have me act. Sometimes I get it completely wrong. I've had unbelievable experience with beautiful, beautiful people and beautiful places and wonderful, wonderful, wonderful blessings and abundance in my life. And I've had unbelievably painful things that seemingly are horrible, and those are God's will as well. I told a friend, right? God, you know, God's got the lamb and the lion. You know what I mean? You know what I mean by that? Like that. God's got them both, but unfortunately, one's getting eaten, right? One experience is going to be different than the other's experience, and I have to remember that some things really, really hard, they're going to show up, but I unquestionably know that God has given me every single resource I need to face any challenge that comes my way. And that doesn't come from antidepressants, and it doesn't come from counsel with others, why I still counsel with others. That comes from my unshakable foundation that I have in place as a result of turning my life and will over to the care of God. See, I never ever heard that all step three was is just deciding to do the rest of the steps. I never heard that until I got to OA. What I was told is when I turn my life and will over to care of God, my life is no longer my business, right? I'm told that I have to cease fighting everything and everyone, and those are painful things to happen. And I'm as grateful for the pain and discomfort and humiliation that I've experienced in my life as I am for all of the blessings that I've received. Because every single one of them has molded me into the person that I am today, and hopefully to the person that I'm eventually going to become, because I'm far from finished. I'm far from finished. And with that, I'll pass.
Thanks, Loretta. Okay, we have a question from Toby, followed by Golda. Toby, good morning.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you, Larry, and thank you, Pete. Pete, would you say more about a 10th step? I hear different ways of doing it, and sometimes it helps and sometimes it doesn't help when I do my 10th step. And I was wondering if we would talk more about that.
Sure, Toby. Thank you for the question. I do the 10th step exactly how the big book writes it and tells me how to do the 10th step. I base my practice of the 10th step on what the AA 12 and 12 says about the 10th step. When selfishness, dishonesty, or resentment show up in my life, I ask God at once to remove them. Thinking about other people, how I could be of service. That's what it says to do. The instructions that we talk to somebody immediately. See, that's one sentence. and make amends quickly, and it has a condition if we've harmed someone. Right? We discuss them with someone immediately. That's called the clause. A clause is a part of a sentence which by itself can stand alone. That can stand alone. We discuss them with someone immediately, period. Except there's no period. Then we have end. That's a conjunction. It combines a clause with a subclause, a dependent clause in this instance. Because
press star one, Pete. Pete, press star one.
Muted.
Is it possible that Pete got knocked off the line? I don't know. I don't see the board there, Nancy. If so, he might be calling back in.
Yep.
Okay. Well, we'll wait for Pete to do that. But that certainly happened to me. I've hung up on myself or got knocked off and I got a call back in. So we'll wait for Pete to do that. In the meantime,
Larry, make sure he starts over because you got to the very best part when he got cut off.
How about now?
Yeah. Hey, Pete. Yeah. I don't know.
Am I back?
You're back. Yeah, you're back.
Where did I drop off? Was anybody listening, or was I being tuned out?
No.
The word because.
Okay. Well, I just go back to this, right? So we have a clause and we have a subclause. If is the condition, right? So we discuss them with somebody immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed someone. So I don't have if I've harmed someone because of my selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, there's no option to not talk to somebody because I have to fix that. I either have to reconcile it with an apology or I have to fix it with an amends, right? Because amends does not mean to change. It means to repair, right? So I don't have an option. So it gives me the reasons why I must talk to somebody. This idea that I have to rely on, again, I'm not minimizing the importance of having a connection. And it is beneficial to start out having conversations with other people. But remember, it says that we're supposed to grow. We're supposed to be growing in understanding and effectiveness. And we have to develop a habit of self-assessment, accurate self-assessment. Right? So that's what the 10th step is for. And it's not, as I understand it, an event. It's a process. It's a process of being aware of what's going on with me, going to the source to have it removed, and focusing not on me, but focusing on someone else, because the only way out of me is through somebody else. I hope that clears it up, and if anybody wants more information on that, feel free to look me up.
Thanks, Pete. Okay, and thanks for the question, Toby. Golda, I have a question for you. Do you love me? Okay, that's a movie. Golda, it's your turn. You got a question for Pete? Good morning.
Actually, yes, thank you, Pete, for your service, and thank you, Larry. My question really was exactly the same question that was just asked, and I got my answer. I, by the way, don't agree with you, but I got my answer about how you see the 10th step, and I'm so glad we all have our, as you said, we all read the big book, and we all go to God with it, and we get our answer through our, you know, our messengers. Whatever. So I really appreciate your service. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Golda. You know, we got time maybe for one or two more questions for Pete. Who would like those? Press star one.
Matthew G.
Matthew.
Colleen M.
I'm sorry. The woman's name, was it Colleen?
Colleen.
Colleen. I'm sorry, Colleen. Don't ever get old. This is what happens when you get old. Okay, Matthew, it's your turn with the question, followed by Colleen. Good morning.
Hey there, good morning. Matthew G., recovered compulsive overeater in France. Thank you so much, Pete. Awesome, awesome, awesome. Thank you for my recovery. Love you so much. My question, I had so many, but one of the things you really helped me with was seeing of when my dishonest thinking of taking things that were, imagining things instead of, could you talk a little about that? Because that was so helpful for me in your helping me get recovered 2 years ago. Thank you so much.
Yeah, sure, Matthew. It's good to hear you, man. It's good to hear you. So, dishonesty, remember, right? It's the book says we have illusions, right? We have delusions. We're riddled with self-deceit. Dishonesty is difficult. It's really hard to be honest about what's going on. Because if I'm honest with myself and if I'm honest with somebody else, it means that I'm getting vulnerable. It also means that I'm looking at something from another's perspective and not only my perspective, right? And me, see, right, because I'm selfish and I'm self-centered, I have a limited ability to look at things from other people's perspective. I only want to look at it from mine, right? So what I had to recognize particularly with dishonesty is that other people, just like me, are entitled, just like the woman said before, everyone's entitled to their own opinion. You can have an opinion, right? We have information that backs up what's being said. If I'm delusional and I don't want to take what it says as something else, that by definition, that's delusional, right? Delusion means that in spite of the evidence that exists, I still choose to look at something my own way. I still choose to look at it the way I want to look at it, right? So that's what delusion means. And many of us are delusional, right? So the way we address dishonesty is that we have to understand that there are other perspectives. Everybody's entitled to their perspective. And the way that somebody may feel about something doesn't have to have anything to do with the way I feel about it, right? Doesn't have to be, that's how being honest plays out for me, right? And what do we do with dishonesty? We ask God to remove it. We ask God to help us see the other side, the other point, what's going on, right? But it doesn't mean that I have to change who I am or I have to modify my understanding of what I'm being directed to do or on how to understand something, right? That's what that means. As God's people, we stand on our feet, right? We don't make excuses for God. Demonstrate through us what he is and what he can do, or she is and what she can do. So I hope that answers the question. Thank you.
Thanks, Matthew. Okay, let's wrap with the question from Colleen. Good morning, Colleen.
Hey, Larry, thank you for your service. And Pete, thank you so much for your service. Colleen M., recovered from Maryland. So, Pete, I was wondering if you could tell us what your spiritual practices on a daily basis might look like. And the other part of my question is, if and when you have struggles with, what does that look like for you and how do you process through that to get to a point of acceptance?
Struggled with what, Colleen? Can you just say that
to,
one?
To get to a point of acceptance, if you have a situation where you're struggling with accepting, or if that ever happens for you, with life and things that we get and lose, if you struggle with acceptance, how does that, what is your process for getting through that?
So thank you, Colleen, for the question. So my spiritual practice, right? Like my formal practices, I follow step 11 as it's outlined in the book. Right. Upon awakening, not like it's written in the book. Usually upon awakening, I like to move. Right. Because I think my God would have me move. Right. So I like to move. And that usually gets me kind of, thinking and kind of clear so that I can get quiet and meditate. So I have a formal meditation practice where I reflect. And I'm better off leaving my house without my pants than I am leaving it without meditating. So I have a meditation practice where I get quiet and I listen for the guidance and the direction that I'm desperately seeking to get. I have a prayer session. That's where I petition to God what I need, right? Because what I need, I need power. I need strength. I need courage. I need determination. And I ask my God for those things. I also take that opportunity to thank God for what he's put in my life and to thank God for what he's taken out of my life and left behind. And then, you know, and to be honest, you know, everything else in my life is a spiritual practice. The way I plan my food, what I put in my body, the way I try to interact with my family, the way I try to interact with people that aren't in my family. Like I say, it's like, I'm not in a program. This is the way of life. This is my way of life, you know? So everything about my life is a spiritual practice. My job, according to the 12 and 12 under step 12, it says even my job is in place for me to serve God. And what I found is when I look at my life as an opportunity to contribute, I always receive. But when I look at my life as some situation as something where I'm just to try to get something, well then sometimes I receive and sometimes I don't, right? Like my whole life is a spiritual practice. Now, do I struggle? Yeah, I'm struggling with shit right now that's as hard as anything I've ever had to experience. It's as difficult as anything I've ever gone through, right? The loss of significant things and activities that I got a great deal of joy out of, I no longer get to participate in, and it's not my choice. And that's hard. Like I have physical withdrawal, you know. But what I can tell you is, like I said earlier, there's no question in my mind that the unshakable foundation I have is that this is going to pass. And just like how it came into my life was an unbelievable blessing, the fact that it's no longer in my life is an unbelievable blessing as well, because it's given me an opportunity to grow and evaluate things, evaluate decisions I've made in the past, and then try to take corrective measures to make some better ones going forward. Right? So, you know, the way that I handle struggle is I'm grateful. I'll always be grateful. I have an unbelievable life. I have a life that's so far beyond my wildest dreams. And when I focus on that, see, I like to focus on the facts, not the feelings. The feelings will tell me, well, you're not good enough. You didn't do that right. You should have did this. You should have did that. Here, this will fix it, right? The facts are, do the best I can with the information I have available at the time. I do the best I can in trying to be the person I think my God would have me be. I try to make the words come out of my mouth that are really going on with me, not tell you what I think I am, not tell you how I think I am. I just try to be me, right? And what I found is, regardless of the situation, I'm good. I'm good. I still have a wonderful life. The facts are the facts. I don't compulsively overeat. I don't use substances that cause the phenomenon of craving. I trust my trust the God of my understanding. I align my will with God's. I do what the book tells me to do. I try to be of maximum service to God and to my fellows. Everything turns out to be all right. I don't have to go to, you know, like I said, I don't have to, you know, fancy myself up and change who I am because I want to make some other reaction from somebody else. I am what I am. And it was good enough for God, so it's probably going to be good enough for anybody else. So, you know, like I'm a work in progress. I'm still going to be a work in progress. If I had to do this thing next week, it might be entirely different. I don't know, right? So all I know is what's going on right now, and what's going on right now is like I have a life beyond my wildest dreams, and everything is going to be okay. And with that, I'll pass.
Hey, Pete, thanks. Appreciate you. Appreciate your generous use to your time this morning. Let me give the share ID. Hang out. Also, we're going to ask for Pete's his contact information, his locker combination, blood type, all that good stuff. But let me give you the share ID for Pete's presentation. That's 21,685,21685. And so we're going to close now from a reading from the big book on page 164. And then after the recording stops, we'll get Pete's info. So our book is meant to be suggestive only.
we realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.